Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Interpreter Radio Show. Chris Fredrickson and Bruce Webster are your hosts tonight. For the second hour, we're going to talk about a couple different subjects. First, we're going to talk about Book of Mormon place names and Book of Mormon names in general and Book of Mormon geography, because this is a common area that's raised as, oh, did you know that Joseph Smith just borrowed the name of a nearby city? Which as usual ignores the rather lengthy and voluminous research that has been done into the authentic ancient nature of Book of Mormon names from various sources.
Stephen Ricks has a new book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And Matt Bowen has done extensive research in this. It's always amazing. The basic idea is, oh, look, there's some place names on the map that look like or sound like a few of the place names in the Book of Mormon. Therefore, Joseph Smith must have just made up the names from here. They don't explain – that does nothing to explain the literally dozens of authentically ancient Egyptian, Hebrew, and ancient Near Eastern names that are used and often used in extremely appropriate ways. Matt Bowen in particular has done a lot of research in showing how there's often a lot of name-related wordplay that goes on in the Book of Mormon, where the names that are given. And, you know, this is I have a hard time spending a lot of time on this topic because, like a lot of Book of Mormon stuff, it's, in my opinion, reflects an ignorance of both the Book of Mormon and the actual scholarship that has been done. And it's sort of hard to, it's like arguing with a flat earther. They have what they think are clever answers, and well, what about this, and what about this, and pretty much ignore the reality of what you find in the Book of Mormon and ignore the reality of what we know from authentically ancient sources. Chris.
And excellent scholarship today.
Yes.
And you know, I want to start off by saying that I think, and I say this from the bottom of my heart, terribly sincerely, critics of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they're going to get stuff in their hands and they're going to throw it at the wall and see what sticks, and hoping to dissuade people from their testimonies of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And they're going to make claims about this and claims about that. And a lot of it is quite compelling. Individuals in the church that work in these areas of the arguments and the claims that that individuals that are antagonistic to the church make, it's a hard thing to do. To work through that material. But I promise you, when I deal with these kinds of questions, and there are a lot of claims floating around there today, and some of them sound so articulate and so well-reasoned, the first thing that I do is I go to the Interpreter website, and I search out that topic, and boom, we'll say Book of Mormon geography. Up will pop 5 to 10 to 15 articles dealing with that very subject, going back to ancient times. These are scholars that understand and that, you know the landscape of that ancient world. They've studied it, the language, the culture, the customs, the archaeology of that ancient world. They're experts in these things, and they can go back and they have written very carefully crafted scholarly papers that have been peer-reviewed, and they're posted on the Interpreter website. If you are working with individuals who are having doubts, who are struggling right now with their testimonies, if they have specific things that they're concerned about, go to the Interpreter website. Type in those keywords. pull up the articles, familiarize yourself with them, pass them on to those people that are struggling. It's amazing the way that they are so good at taking apart these fallacious arguments that are being made in the world today. This doesn't discount the fact that there's lots of new stuff that we're learning right now. There's lots of stuff we're learning today that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, but he was a product of the day and age in which he lived. He was socialized certain beliefs and practices and ideas just as we are today. And when those blinders are taken away, we're going to be a little bit probably chagrined at some of the beliefs and some of the practices that, you know, we held on to. When we understand, you know, when we see things more clearly rather than seeing them through a glass darkly. But that's what culture does to it. It sometimes puts us in a place where we see through a glass darkly. But so you're going to hear things that Joseph Smith said that were in keeping with the sentiments of his day, that he thought made sense with the gospel of Jesus Christ as he was learning it, just as we learn it every day of our lives. But he learned it at quite a rapid pace and in quite an extraordinary way. And they don't always accord with current science, but we're still learning things today. But go to that website and take advantage of all of those resources. It's the first thing I did when we started talking sort of about Book of Mormon geography and some of the claims that are out there today, and certainly found more than enough and sufficient to help me better understand the truth of, you know, some of these, the truth or the reality of some of the false claims that are being made.
Now, let me give you an example of what happens when you actually dig into the source material instead of trying to score cheap points on bad data. some years ago, my gosh, this is like, how long has that been? 14 years ago? It's basically, I think when I was teaching, I may have been teaching, if we were studying Book of Mormon Gospel Doctrine, I don't think I was teaching at the time, but I wrote a series of posts on a blog, and someone had raised an issue about the term anti-Nephi Lehi's and what it meant and so on. Now, I have, I think, all the volumes of Royal Skousen's critical text of the Book of Mormon, not the one where he actually dissects each verse at great length. And one of the issues he raises here, he says, well, we have sort of three things here. First, was this an effort in a translation? Was Joseph using the Greek term anti to mean in opposition of and so on? Was it anti, the Latin term, which sort of means before, like antebellum or anti-Nicene fathers and so on? Or was it a actual Nephite phoneme with some meaning that we don't necessarily know? And that led me, because I'm a geek and because I studied linguistics and in college and so on and so forth, and because I can do text searches, I said, oh, well, let's see all the places where the phoneme A-N-T-I shows up in the Book of Mormon. And I discovered something very interesting. All the place and proper names that use the phoneme A-N-T-I, with one exception, show up in a single book in the Book of Mormon. It's the Book of Alma. They don't appear anywhere else, with one exception, and that exception is a personal name in the Book of Mormon, where an individual has the same name as a place name from the Book of Alma, which is actually true of Mormon himself. The second thing I discovered is that every individual who has a name starting with A-N-T-I is a leader. Either he's either a king, a ruler, or a military leader. Antiono, Antiona, Antionum, Antipas, and Anti-Nephi Lehi, which is the name adopted by the king over them. There are a number of place names that use it. In many cases, there's nothing to indicate other than the fact that this is a place name. But every place where it is used with a distinguishing geographic element, it's a hill or a mountain. So you've got – so my assumption or my conclusion was basically in support of Royal Skousen This is actually a Nephite phoneme, and it has something to do with supremacy, because it's either, if it's a proper name, it's a ruler. Mm. If it's a name of a known geographical location, it's a hill or a mountain. I'm sure Joseph Smith came up with that by looking at a map of upstate New York. And by the way, confined all of those uses to the Book of Alma, a particular section out of, 500 pages. my point in this is not, well, it was, I found it an interesting analysis, but the point is that when you run across this type of back of the envelope stuff that people say, oh, well, look, there's a place name named Angola. Well, we know that Angola exists, over in Africa. Therefore, Joseph must have just picked it from there. And leaving aside all the issues of translation, transliteration, and everything else, this is Chris talked about cheap grace. This is cheap scholarship. It's not real scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
It's someone trying to muddy the waters,
mm-hmm. and not peer reviewed.
Definitely not peer reviewed. No. In fact,
peer reviewed simply means that you have a group of scholars that before you ever put it to paper or before you ever post it online, they carefully review every word of the text, every thought, every idea, every claim. They look for evidence. They look for a good, strong thesis. I mean, there are certain things that they look for in a paper before they're going to give it any credence enough to publish it.
Now, having been, as I've mentioned before, I joined the church back in 1967, so we're talking 55 years ago, and within months of joining the church, I had well-meaning friends start to hand me anti-Mormon literature, which, as I've described before, is pretty much how I started doing things like reading comprehensive history of the church and, Jesus the Christ and Articles of Faith and so on and so forth, and why I have a pretty sizable library today. But the point is that I actually read and study, and here's the interesting thing. And this is something I've thought of, and my understanding is I believe that the fine people over at Book of Mormon Central are actually working to put together something like this. After 50 years of reading, if you will, Book of Mormon apologetics, what I have found is that time and again, things that were at one point, I mean, really started going all the way back to 1830 or whatever, at one point were pointed to as obvious indications that the Book of Mormon was a fraud, have actually turned out to be proof of its authenticity. Things that people say, oh, no, that would never happen, and said, oh, hey, look, we have this. We know this. In fact, this was a bullseye that the Book of Mormon made that no one happened to think. And, the classic example, if you want to go all the way back to 1830, is why he's talking about civilizations with highways and great cities and great armies and writings and so on and so forth. And, of course, now we have Mesoamerica, where we have, increasing, even to the present day, increasing evidence of the vast populations in Mesoamerica during Book of Mormon times, numbering millions of people with highways, with illiteracy, with writing and everything else.
Very sophisticated.
Yeah, very sophisticated.
The Mayans, the Incans, the Toltecs, Aztecs, very sophisticated.
So it's – but there's been lots more that has come up. And really, Hugh Nibley was the pioneer in this with his approach to the Book of Mormon since Cumorah. The Prophetic Book of Mormon and so on. Farms picked it up and then passed a torch on to the Interpreter Foundation, Book of Mormon Central, Fair LDS. this is the evidences have grown stronger for the Book of Mormon instead of weaker. Think about that. Book of Mormon was published almost 200 years ago. If this were really an invention or a fraud, it would have been shredded to pieces long ago. No one can credibly account for its creation. Spalding theory has been debunked time and again. Mm-hmm. You have automatic writing. You have a few other things. None of them hold water. And the historical evidence, once again, as historical evidence has been gathered, and you have particularly through the Joseph Smith papers, the correlation of the events from contemporaneous historical documents or contemporaneous witnesses of the process of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, there's nothing to support, literally nothing to give any support or credence to the various alternate theories. Everything supports the actual story as we know it of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. A great single volume work came out a few years ago is called From Darkness into Light. I can't tell you the author's names off the top of my head, but it goes through that in meticulous detail, the actual historical record of the coming, the translation and publication of the Book of Mormon. And there is no credible alternate explanation other than people saying, well, it couldn't have been divine providence, therefore it had to be something else. I mean, that is literally begging the question.
And, you know, and in our day, the evidences are so replete. And there are things that we can do in our day that we could never do before. Language studies. To look at the language of the different authors in the Book of Mormon, they have taken those language patterns by those different authors of the books in the Book of Mormon. Now, an author writes with a certain voice. If you read J.D. Salinger once, you're going to recognize him ever after because there's a certain pattern to his language. I don't recommend reading him. And the same thing, you're going to sort of hear Jane Austen's voice in your head over and over again after you read her over and over again. And I love Jane Austen, so I would recommend that one, and Dickens and some of these other great, you know, Victorian writers. But in the Book of Mormon, those studies have shown that every single one of those books is a distinctive voice and very different from the other voices in the Book of Mormon. Now, there certainly was an editor that oversaw all the publication of this, and yet that distinction stands out. You know, when we talk about Book of Mormon geography, I'm one of those people that has always been, if the purpose was to know specifically where these places were, then Heavenly Father might have articulated it more clearly. That's not the purpose of the book. The purpose of the book is to bring us closer to Jesus Christ, to gain a testimony of his gospel, of his teachings, his policies, his practices, to help us to come unto Jesus Christ and to be his disciples. And it's the best book on earth to help us to do that. And that's what his intention is. It's a testimony of Jesus Christ, of his reality, of his atonement, and of salvation possible for everyone that has or will live on the earth. And I'm grateful for that. But when we talk about Book of Mormon geography, there's some other interesting things, and there's claims out there today. And I just want to, I'll review one that we're hearing. And there is the argument out there, and again, interpreter article, Interpreter Foundation, it's called Estimating the Evidence, Episode 12, on Hebraic Views and Late Wars, regarding a book called A View of the Hebrews by the Reverend Ethan Smith, who was quasi-contemporary of the prophet Joseph Smith or the Oliver Cowdery family. Some people try to make a connection with him there. So the claim is made, the inference of plagiarism. And the author of this article has very carefully shown and disproves the inference that there was plagiarism and that there is a close connection between the two books, the Book of Mormon and A View of the Hebrews, that certainly Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery were likely aware of the theme and the content of A View of the Hebrews, but striking similarities to the overarching premise of the Book of Mormon and many of its detailed details, there's no comparison to be made. Those surface level details are essentially where that correspondence ends. The Book of Mormon includes many details and historical claims that cannot be attributed to A View of the Hebrews. With regard to A View of the Hebrews, there's also the claim that Ethan Smith shared a congregation for a time with the family of Oliver Cowdery, which he did. So that's where the Book of Mormon got their material, is, you know, by plagiarizing this book, is the claim that many people that are antagonistic to the church make. And yet the reality is that the Book of Mormon, the theme, the framework, much of the writing was put into writing long before Oliver Cowdery even entered the picture. Oliver Cowdery came a little late to the scene. They certainly are starting from one point on with Oliver Cowdery, but you'll remember that Joseph Smith had been working basically on the Book of Lehi for a long period of time. We already had the theme. We already had the names of people. We already had the individuals. We already had doctrinal expositions long before Oliver Cowdery even came into contact with Joseph Smith. And so that, again, disproves that claim. And so I encourage you, go to, you know, Interpreter website. Check out, you know, those well-researched arguments that counter these false claims that people just kind of throw on the wall and really poor scholarship. And let me also encourage you, read the book itself, okay? Just deep dive into the Book of Mormon. Read it over and over again. It's the most sublime. I mean, I love the Doctrine and Covenants too. I'll pair them together. But doctrinally, story-wise, I mean, and the complication, you're telling me a young man in his 20s with no education whatsoever, with no real understanding of ancient societies, the world around us, he was a student of the Bible, Joseph Smith loved the Bible, was capable of writing such a detailed and such, I mean, if you're talking about a really tricky plot line, you're not going to find one much trickier than the Book of Mormon. But the way that it interworks and interweaves, but when you start reading the scriptures, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, sublime, read them over and over again, just deep dive into the words there, you're going to get a testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then when you start reading the Bible and you see the way that these pair up and they match up with that ancient biblical world and much of the stuff that's going on in the Book of Mormon, it's absolutely mind-boggling. And then when you get all the temple themes in the Doctrine and Covenants that are there, it just is going to blow you away. So not just read articles that challenge the claims that individuals made, but study the faith and study the doctrine of the faith itself as articulated in those books. And it will profoundly improve and bless and benefit your life and those around you.
I will resist quoting Marian Hanks and Theological Illiterates because I seem to do that every month. Instead, I'll quote Alexander Pope. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not that Parian spring. Their shallow draughts intoxicate the brain, but drinking deeply sobers us again. The shallowness of most Book of Mormon criticism is appalling from an academic point of view. It is truly shallow. It does nothing to address. I probably have 40 or 50 academic books on the Book of Mormon with footnotes from scholars with actual degrees. The critics out there, by and large, have no degrees, have no relevant academic background, and totally ignore the relevant sources.
And they ignore. This is the job of, theoretically, the job of historians. It's a historian's job to look at the evidence, not to pick and choose what they draw from, and then not to warp the interpretation when they give an interpretation to align with their personal views. And yet that's what you see over and over again in much of this antagonistic literature. It's a warping, it's a hiding of evidence, and it's a warping of
it's ill intended.
Yeah. Ill intended.
The purpose is not to discover truth.
Nope.
The purpose is to attack institutions and people, mm-hmm. And to shake the faith of members. Mm-hmm. These people do not have your well-being in mind. Mm-hmm. They want to shake your faith. They want to take delight in you losing faith and losing sight. And in many cases, it's working. And at some point, you'll have to answer to the Lord.
But
you know,
and as Alexander Pope said, this is important too. Deep dive.
Yeah.
Deep dive. And we live in a world where people want a soundbite answer. short, pithy. They want my students. They don't want to read the book. They just want to do the spark notes.
Yeah.
They lose, you know, if it's a Jane Austen book, they're going to lose their understanding of the human condition. They're maybe going to get the brief plot line, but they're not going to find the beauty of it as it explores the human condition. We've got a deep dive as members of the church. That's essential for a testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's not just some little blurb that someone throws up on, you know, their social media feed. That's not going to help you at all. So take advantage of the opportunity to go to the source. And I'm going to say something about Alexander Pope. This is in reference. I'm going to refer back here to our talk on pornography. My favorite quote by Alexander Pope: "Vice is a monster of so frightful mien," that means visage, "as to be hated needs but to be seen. Yet seen too oft, familiar with her face, we first endure, then pity, then embrace." It was a brilliant, yeah. It was a brilliant mind, and 18th century mind, and worthy of study.
Okay, well, that brings our second hour to an end. Our second half hour to an end.